This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of 2 Chronicles. And now here's Pastor Sandy in the book of 2 Chronicles, chapters 1 through 5.
Solomon needs talent and timber, and so he goes to Hiram. And here's what's in it for Hiram. "And indeed, I will give to your servants, the woodsmen who cut timber, 20,000 cores of ground wheat, 20,000 cores of barley, 20,000 baths of wine, and 20,000 baths of oil." Now, a core was a dry measurement, the equivalent of 11 bushels. A bath was a liquid volume of about 9 gallons. This means that Hiram will receive 220,000 bushels of wheat and barley and 180,000 gallons of wine and oil. Tyre's partnership with Solomon proved quite lucrative for King Hiram. Verse 11, "Then Hiram, king of Tyre, answered in writing, which he sent to Solomon, because the Lord loves his people, he has made you king over them. Hiram also said, blessed be the Lord God of Israel, who made heaven and earth." You know, his faith in Jehovah was probably the reason that he got along so well with David and then Solomon. Whether Hiram worshiped God alone, we're not sure, but he's what we might call a God-fearing man. He respected the God of Israel, no doubt. And Hiram continues in verse 12, "For he has given King David a wise son, endowed with prudence and understanding, who will build a temple for the Lord and a royal house for himself." He respected David, and he respected David's family. "And now I have sent a skillful man, endowed with understanding, Huram." Hiram sends Huram. "My master craftsman, the son of a woman of the daughters of Dan, and his father was a man of Tyre." Huram was half Israeli. "Skilled to work in gold and silver, bronze and iron, stone and wood, purple and blue, cloth, fabric, embroidery, so forth, fine linen and crimson, and to make any engraving and to accomplish any plan which may be given to him with your skillful men and with the skillful men of my Lord David, your father." This Huram was quite talented. This is kind of like a Bob Vila. This is kind of like Bob Vila, you know. The guy that can do anything. You know, he can work with fabric, he can embroidery, he can work with wood, he can work with metals. Talented guy. Evidently, this half Phoenician, half Israeli named Huram had all of the above. "Now therefore, the wheat, the barley, the oil, and the wine, which my Lord has spoken of, let him send to his servants, and we will cut wood from Lebanon as much as you need. We will bring it to you in rafts by sea to Joppa, and you will carry it up to Jerusalem." Hiram says, "Pay us first, and then we'll deliver the goods." And he says that he'll float the timber down the coast rather than hauling it across the land. And that was smart. That would be an easy way to transport all of this timber down to Jerusalem. Joppa was the Mediterranean port closest to Jerusalem. Just 35 miles northwest of Jerusalem is the coastal town of Joppa. It's just a little south of the modern city of Tel Aviv. This was a good plan. We'll float it down the coast and then we'll bring it up from the from Joppa. Verse 17. "Then Solomon numbered all the aliens who were in the land of Israel after the census in which David his father had numbered them, and there were found to be 153,600. And he made 70,000 of them bearers of burdens, 80,000 stone cutters in the mountain, and 3,600 overseers to make the people work." Rather than subject the Israelites to this hard, manual, back-breaking labor required to quarry and then transport these huge granite stones, Solomon drafted the Gentiles, the non-citizens living in the land of Israel, to do this kind of work. Isn't it interesting? Jesus will later refer to the temple as a house of prayer for all nations. Jesus understood that the temple belonged to all nations. It's strange that later Jews barred the Gentiles from even entering the temple. when it was the Gentiles who helped build the temple. Just kind of ironic. Well, chapter 3 begins. Now Solomon began to build the house of the Lord at Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, where the Lord had appeared to his father David at the place that David had prepared on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. Now there is a Jewish legend that explains how the site for the temple was chosen. Two brothers had fallen on hard times, but rather than worry about themselves, they were concerned about each other. And without knowing it, each of them went out and bought a food basket. And in the middle of the night, they went to take that food basket and put it on the other brother's doorstep. As the story goes, they bumped into each other in the moonlight. And when they saw each other's generosity and what they had planned to do, they put down the food baskets and they hugged each other. And the temple was built where the brothers embraced. And for years to come, the site of the temple would unify Israel. Rather than worship in multiple locations, God did centralize the worship for Israel at the temple in Jerusalem. This ensured purity and unity. Solomon's temple was the one place where man was sure he could come and embrace God, and brother could embrace brother. Of course, the biblical reason for where the temple was built is a bit different. When God brought judgment on David because of his prideful senses, the king was told to build an altar to God on the threshing floor of Ornan. A threshing floor now was a raised platform, place where the wind could blow by and separate the wheat from the chaff. And it was at the platform of Ornan that the angel of judgment was told by God to return his drawn sword to its scabbard and to stop the judgment that had fallen upon Jerusalem. David then purchased this property from Ornan, 35 acres on Mount Moriah. It's become rather famous. And it was here that Solomon built the temple. And this is why this piece of real estate that David bought for Solomon and for the construction of the temple, a piece of real estate we today call the Temple Mount. This is why this place remains in contention today. For the modern Jews want to rebuild their temple. What is Judaism without its temple? But you see, God does not allow them to construct their temple just anywhere. No, God has decreed a particular site for his temple. Ornan's threshing floor is the only biblical option for a Jewish temple. And that's why it's such a hot spot in the world at the moment. Currently under Muslim religious authorities' control, a point of contention, obviously, between Jews and between Muslims. Remember also, Abraham offered up to God his only son Isaac on Mount Moriah. It's possible that Abraham's act of devotion took place either on or near the place where Solomon built the temple. Now, verse 2. And Solomon began to build on the second day of the second month in the fourth year of his reign. The fourth year of the reign of Solomon was probably 967 B.C. 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 38 tells us that it took over 7 years to complete the construction of the temple. There's a Jewish legend that claims not a single worker died while employed in the work of the temple. In fact, not a single worker became ill during the construction of the temple. Imagine 150,000 workers over a 7.5 year period and not a single sick day. That's miraculous. The legend also claims that the tools stayed sharp and unimpaired for the 7.5 years, so there was never any interruption of the work. Verse 3. This is the foundation which Solomon laid for the building, the house of God. The length was 60 cubits. By cubits, according to the former measure, and the width, 20 cubits. A cubit was originally the distance from the tip of the king's finger to his elbow. And the standardized cubit of Solomon's day was probably around 18 inches. And thus the temple proper, The holy place and the holy of holies was 90 foot long by 30 foot wide, twice the size of the tabernacle that it replaced. And the vestibule that was in front of the sanctuary was 20 cubits long across the width of the house, and the height was 120. Now, 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 3 says that it was 10 cubits deep. So the temple foyer, you might call it, or the vestibule, the little, see the little extension on the front of the house there? The temple vestibule was 30 feet by 15 feet. 1 Kings also tells us the holy place and the holy of holies behind the foyer was 30 cubits high, or 45 feet high. That would have classified as a cathedral ceiling. A building 90 by 30 feet with a 45-foot ceiling, be pretty high ceiling. Now here we're told the foyer's height. And you got to picture this. A 30-foot by 15-foot room was 120 cubits or 180 feet tall from our text here in Chronicles. Your Bible probably provides a footnote in verse 3 and says that it could read 20 cubits or 30 feet, which would seem to be more architecturally appropriate. The Hebrew words 100 and cubits are easily confused. They do look alike. And this may be a rare occasion where the Hebrew manuscripts differ. And this is why some temple renderings appear like what we've just seen, but others appear with this huge, tall facade in front of the holy place. That's why there's a difference of opinion there. Many people take this literally 120 cubits, which would make it this big, huge, you know, tower in front of the tabernacle, the temple. Other people, you know, go along with 1 Kings and consider it to be 30 feet tall. Many of the rabbis reconcile the 120 cubits by saying that Chronicles gave a spiritual meaning while the literal height of the temple porch was 30 feet. Whatever its height, he overlaid the inside with pure gold, the larger room. Now remember, the temple contained two rooms: the holy place where the priests worked, and the holy of holies where the presence of God resided. In the larger room, or the holy place, he paneled with cypress, which he overlaid with fine gold, and he carved palm trees and chain work on it. The palm trees spoke of fruitfulness and prosperity. And he decorated the house with precious stones for beauty, and the gold was gold from Parvaim, someplace deep into the Orient. Some people even suggest Southeast Asia. He also overlaid the house, the beams and doorposts, its walls and doors, with gold. And he carved cherubim on the walls. Now remember, the tabernacle and the temple were both a model of God's throne in heaven. And since cherubim are the angels that surround God's heavenly throne, it was only fitting that they be seen in the temple. Notice again, the temple's interior was overlaid with the purest of gold. And he made the most holy place. It's also called the Holy of Holies. And this is where the Shekinah glory, the glory of God, rested in the temple, in the inner sanctum, in the 30 by 30 foot square, the inner sanctum within the temple. Its length was, according to the width of the house, 20 cubits or 30 feet, and its width, 20 cubits. The inner sanctum was 30 foot square, and he overlaid it with 600 talents of fine gold, or that's about 60,000 pounds of gold. My, oh my. At today's price, that gold would have been worth $624 million. Verse 9, the weight of the nails was 50 shekels of gold, and he overlaid the upper area with gold. Imagine they used gold nails in the Holy of Holies. And they must have been more like bolts because they weighed nearly 2 pounds apiece, 50 shekels. You and I have never seen anything as ornate as Solomon's temple. In the most holy place, he made two cherubim fashioned by carving and overlaid them with gold. The wings of the cherubim were 20 cubits in overall length. One wing of the one cherub was 5 cubits, touching the wall of the room, and then the other wing was 5 cubits, touching the wing of the other cherubim. One wing of the other cherub was 5 cubits, touching the wall of the room, and the other wing was also 5 cubits, touching the wing of the other cherub. The wings of these cherubim spanned 20 cubits overall. They stood on their feet, and they faced inward. The wingspan of these two cherubim filled the Holy of Holies. Their bodies must have been facing forward while their faces turned back toward the ark. Revelation chapter 4 tells us that there are 4 living creatures, or cherubim, around the throne of God in heaven. It's interesting that there were also 4 cherubim in the temple. Now, where do we get 4? We've just talked about 2. But you also remember that there were 2 that were made onto the mercy seat that covered the Ark of the Covenant. Therefore, there were 4 cherubim in the temple, just as there are 4 cherubim in heaven today. The cherubim, of course, in the temple were reminders to Israel that though we never worship angels, we always worship with angels. For we join in their praise and they join in our praise as we worship the grace and glory of God. Well, the next few verses bring up more questions than they answer. Verse 14 tells us, "And he made the veil of blue, purple, crimson, and fine linen, and wove cherubim into it." In 1 Kings, rather than a veil, we're told of a 4-paneled olive wood door that separated the holy place from the Holy of Holies. So which was it? Was it a cloth veil, or was it an olive wood door? I don't know. Perhaps it was both. Also, he made in front of the temple 2 pillars 35 cubits high. 35 cubits, 52 and a half feet. 1 Kings tells us they were cast in bronze, and they stood at the entrance to the holy place. And the capital that was on the top of each of them was 5 cubits. He made wreaths of chain work as in the inner sanctuary and put them on top of the pillars. And he made 100 pomegranates and put them in the wreaths of chain work. Now the capital was an ornamental feature that sat on top of the pillars, sort of the equivalent to our crown molding. You know, you put the crown molding up to kind of give you that little fancy flair, you know. That's kind of what the capital was. At its height and pillars, it along with the 35-cubit pillars, the pillars rose to 60 feet, 15 feet above the roof line. But here's another problem. 1 Kings 7 tells us that these pillars were 18 cubits high, not 35 cubits high that we find here. They were about half the height mentioned here in 2 Chronicles. And so what's the deal? Well, it could be that both pillars were actually cast as one pillar, 35 cubits long, and then cut and rounded off. That's a possibility. There's another possibility. It could be that the 18 cubits in 1 Kings was just the pillar, whereas the 35 cubits included all of the ornamentation that was on top of the pillar. Or it could be that there was a very rare transcription error in the text that we possess here. For the Hebrew letters that denote the number, and you know, numbers in Hebrew are actually letters. The Hebrew letters that denote the number 18, Yod and Cheth, look a lot like the number 35, which would be Lamed and He, which was the H. See the H and see the CH? Not a lot of difference between the two, are there? A smudge, a scribal error could account for the discrepancy, which brings up an even larger question. Does this mean that our Bibles contain errors? And the short answer to that is no. That's not what it means. The original manuscripts of the Bible were inerrant without any error or mistake. The problem, though, is that we no longer have the originals, or the autographs, as they're called. We have manuscript copies. Now, we have some very old copies that get us real close to the original. We also have lots of copies that allow us to check, you know, back and forth between manuscripts to check if they're on any discrepancies. And amazingly, all these old copies and the many copies that we have of these manuscripts that we possess, most are nearly identical. The copies are in 99% agreement with each other. You see, the Hebrews to whom God entrusted the writing down and the transcribing of the Bible, they did an extremely effective and exact and faithful job in the transcription of the text of our Bibles. In fact, in 1947, a famous discovery took place. The Dead Sea Scrolls were found. And the Dead Sea Scrolls provided amazing validation of the Old Testament's reliability. The scrolls contain copies of the Old Testament 1,000 years older than anything that we previously possessed. And the Dead Sea Scrolls proved that the Bible you hold in your hand is essentially the same Old Testament that was read by Jesus. And in the 1% of the text that does differ, like here, none of the discrepancies impact any significant doctrines. It's usually just numbers or spelling. And does this erode my confidence in the Bible? No way. As a matter of fact, it makes my faith more realistic. The preservation of the copies of the Bible on which we depend today have been a partnership between God and man. Because man is a part of that partnership, small errors are possible. But since God is involved, our mistakes can never undermine His plan. Well, verse 17. Then he set up the pillars before the temple, one on the right hand and the other on the left. He called the name of the one on the right hand, Jachin, and the name of the one on the left, Boaz. Jachin means he shall establish. Boaz means in him is strength. And the pillars that stood outside the temple were vivid reminders to the worshiper of God's faithfulness and God's power. And these are reminders to us of the temple that Jesus is building today, the church. For in Matthew 16, verse 18, Jesus said, I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. Jesus pointed to His faithfulness and to His power. Today, God dwells in His church. We are His temple. And Jesus is building a strong and a glorious church that will bring His people together and that will bring God glory. Chapter 4 begins. Moreover, he made a bronze altar. 20 cubits was its length, 20 cubits its width, and 10 cubits its height. 30 foot square by 15 feet high. This bronze altar was the barbecue pit. It was where the sacrifices were offered. And then he made the sea of cast bronze. Now this was the basin where the priest would wash before they entered the temple. In the tabernacle, it was a laver. It was a small basin. But in the temple, it's called the sea because of its size. It was much larger. Remember, the priesthood had also grown in number, and therefore a larger bowl was needed to accommodate the crowd of priests.
Being on the go is something we're all accustomed to in this culture. The hustle and bustle of life seems to make the days just fly by. For most of us, our smartphones are sort of an extension of our bodies, constantly ringing and dinging, telling us where to be and what the next appointment is. The technology that we enjoy in this day and age is amazing. And while there's certainly no end to the bad things we can find online and through our smartphones, there's also some great kingdom-minded options. We'd like to invite you to download the Sandy Adams mobile app. Our mobile app is available for iPhone, Android, and Windows smartphones. Or log on to sandyadams.org and simply click on the link from the main menu. When you download the app, you'll be able to listen to the most recent messages taught by Pastor Sandy, browse the series archive, and search the archive alphabetically. Finally, when you download the mobile app, you'll also have the opportunity to join us live for our Sunday morning worship service right from your smartphone. Again, to download the Sandy Adams mobile app, simply enter Sandy Adams in the search options of your smartphone's app store, or log on to sandyadams.org and simply click on the mobile app option right on the homepage. And please join us again as Pastor Sandy continues teaching through the Bible right here on Sandy Adams Radio.